History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and invest the time to patiently listen to those details as they emerge. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to focus on this week is one that you may or may not be familiar with, but one that has added layer upon layer over the years as more is learned about the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history. In fact, that distinction is contained in the title of the most recent bestseller about the USS Indianapolis. 76 years ago this week, 317 survivors out of a crew of just under 1,200 were trying to recover from an ordeal that, even as they try to describe it, many have deemed indescribable. This past week, the USS Indianapolis Legacy Organization organized a virtual reunion. After Marine Edgar Harrell's passing in May, there are now only 5 Indy survivors still with us. You're going to hear the memories of 2 of them today, and I'll also add another layer with a Marine who helped unload the Indy's all-important cargo on Tinian just days before her sinking. If you are not yet following the USS Indianapolis on Facebook, I highly recommend it. Elements of the reunion are featured there, as well as an upcoming opportunity for you to help honor the 888 who died aboard the Indy, either in the kamikaze attack off of Okinawa a few months earlier in 1945, or in her fateful sinking at the end of July. You may remember that the cruiser had left California's Bay Area with undisclosed cargo under around the clock guard by a team of Marines. It wasn't until much later that the crew would learn they had transported crucial components of the atomic bombs that would be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On the way from the West Coast to Tinian, there was much speculation among the crew as to what actually might be inside that mysterious packaging. Harold Bray is the youngest living survivor at 94, and he remembers some of that scuttlebutt.
A lot of guessing, mostly by girls, though.
They thought there were some girls inside of there?
No. I don't know. Those guys are crazy, you know. I don't remember any of the stuff that I ever said was in there, but I walked by it many times. You couldn't even get near it. And they didn't know what they were guarding. They didn't know what it was.
I heard some people thought it was a bunch of beer in there.
Oh, well, that was guessed too, a bunch of beer. We could have drank that beer, too.
I think you would have been willing to drink just about anything when you were in the water for 4.5 days.
Yeah, I could have used a few beers those days.
Well, what about for you? So I'm curious, you specifically, since you're 18 and this is your very first journey on this ship.
Yeah.
So you guys leave here and you deliver those components to Tinian. What was that journey like? Were there any experiences along the way that stand out?
Well, being on that ship and my first ship ever, big or small, sitting on a fantail and watching. We were doing 35 knots. I couldn't believe we were moving that fast. That big old, this thing is a big ship, doing 35 knots. It was a really experience for me. Of course, you couldn't even write home and tell about it because all your mail was special. I mean, everything. My mother would get a letter from me with everything crossed out. I couldn't tell her nothing. It was a big experience for me, but lucky to live through it.
Did you have a concept of the significance of the submarine threat and that you guys might be susceptible to that?
They didn't tell us too much, but they didn't want to scare us, I guess. Because they just come back from being hit.
So you guys get to Tinian, and you see them unload this precious cargo, this top secret package.
Yeah. We didn't know what it was, though. We didn't know till we got in a hospital in the Philippines what we had, what we did.
And when you're leaving Tinian, as I understand it, McVeigh requested an escort and was denied?
And he refused.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need one.
Didn't need one because there shouldn't be any submarines where you're going.
Well, they figured we could outrun any sub. She was pretty fast.
Yeah.
But I didn't know a sub was around, so she shot us third day out of Tinian.
Typically, you would sleep below deck. But because it was so hot, they told you can sleep topside?
Yeah. That's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right. I took my shoes off and my clothes on. And when about midnight, a little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off of that, I was like a 10-foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen my shoes go over the side. And I was dressed with dungarees on and sleeping on the open like that. And I got down on the quarter deck, and it was just amazing. It seemed like we carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarter deck when I got down there. And they started to bail off. We were still on our way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarter deck. I got down on the quarter deck, and guys were going nuts or running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding, some guys. I stopped at the quarter deck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to, I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of a pocket, and I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side where we were on the Fantail, so she was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one, and all that time she was keeling over. And by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side. And instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarter deck instead of floating off. And I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarter deck. And that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water, and I could see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. But I hit the surface. And when I come to the surface, I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already. Mm-hmm. And the guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled. And I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on it. We had a raft. So we picked up, I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft. And so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side, but other than that, it was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
A couple of things I want to ask you about there. One, do I understand correctly that was the very first night you were sleeping topside?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my deck was three decks down, next to sick bay. My bunk was here, where it was stack of three bunks, and I was on top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So,
and isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah,
and decided to sleep up on top of the. On top of a steel deck rather than in my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladeck and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where is it going to go? Where is it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit, but she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down, and you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves, no escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves. And that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. We didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No. We're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned?
Yeah. My whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, but it was all on my left side. But that salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
But it burns, you know, until it scabbed over and it was couple of days. The salt water was no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned, you're covered in oil, you have no food, no water?
No. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun because we were oiled from head to toe. It had eyes and mouth, tongue, still taste it to this day.
Oof.
It was you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached, floating there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. We I don't know how many guys. We ended up with 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Oh, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. If you're on the outer edge of this group, we counted up the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pecos life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. They were flash burns. They weren't deep burns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old. You're burned. You're covered in oil. No food, no water. And now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple times. Once I got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But the face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. That was pretty, pretty scary. Because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait as well.
Well, and sharks weren't the only reason
that
guys died. Can you give us some other examples of what you saw happening that prevented some of those other sailors from surviving?
Well, the burns, some guys were really burned pretty bad. And then, of course, drinking that salt water, go crazy. And they never taught us anything in boot camp about that, you know. Of course, I was out of boot camp a couple of months before I got on a ship. They never talked about, because she just got back from the war zone, and she just repaired. She was taken pretty hard at Okinawa. She took a couple of good hits there. That's when I got on her, when she got back from there. Then we went right back out there and got hit again.
So some of the guys around you, even on your raft, because you had no fresh water,
no,
and you're getting pounded by the sun while it's up, some guys resorted to drinking that salt water.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd have hallucinations and maybe just go under or swim to some vision.
A lot of the guys just attack other guys, you know. They went crazy. And I just had enough sense to stay away from them. I don't know what made me do this, but I stayed by myself most of the time. Matter of fact, I swam away from the group and got a raft by myself for one day. And then I started picking up survivors, and they were just hanging on to each other.
As I just imagine, and it's really impossible for us to imagine going through this, because except for you guys, no one's gone through something this insane.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that initially, the first night, the first couple days maybe even, there's a fair amount of hope that someone's going to find you guys?
Yeah, I don't know if we had any radio guys in our group or not, but they got a radio message off. But never was one, I don't think. We had airplanes go over every day, and they were way too high. And the last day in the water, I was looking to the horizon and seeing this airplane just come, like it just came up like this out of the horizon and came right at us. And it wasn't looking for us. Flew right over us, and then we was screaming and splashing in the water, and he saw us, give us the wing thing. And he came back and did it again, and I seen him go straight up, and that's when he radioed what he had. And, of course, it was another day and a half before we got rescued, but we knew somebody knew where we were. But other than that, nobody knew where we got hit. Then they took us off the board in the Philippines, thinking they were already in there. We're supposed to report in, but I guess somebody messed up and took us off the board and didn't know where we were. Just a stroke of luck that we ever discovered.
It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more about the relief of being rescued when we come back. Don't forget to hop on Facebook and follow the USS Indianapolis page. I also have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Does this ever happen to you? You hear a promotion for a blood drive, but you can't donate because you did so too recently? Trust me, I know the feeling, which is why I'm giving you advance notice. Circle Thursday, August 26th on your calendar for the Central Valley Trailer Repair Blood Drive. It's a pint for a pint. Show up between 1:30 and 5:30, donate your life-saving blood, and you'll receive a coupon good for a free pint of Baskin-Robbins ice cream. Whichever flavor you prefer, I'm a little partial to peach or strawberry myself, but it's going to taste that much better in our triple-digit temperatures, and you're going to feel even better for helping to save lives. It really is that simple. That's Thursday, August 26th at Central Valley Trailer Repair. The address is 2974 Southeast Avenue in Fresno. And if that date doesn't work, the Central California Blood Center is still in need, so you can make other arrangements at donateblood.org. Thanks in advance for your life-saving gift, and thanks to Central Valley Trailer Repair for their support.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, shining a spotlight this week on the USS Indianapolis as we mark 76 years since that cruiser's fateful sinking, followed by the heroic rescue of 317 members of her crew of nearly 1,200. It's quite likely that zero would have survived without the man survivors have long referred to as their angel, Chuck Gwynn, and his unexpected discovery on August 2, 1945. As Harold Bray recalls, the Indianapolis had never been reported sunk or missing when Gwynn spotted some of the survivors from his PV-1 Ventura.
He just seen us by accident. He wasn't even looking for us.
What did you say to him the first time you got to meet him?
I think I kissed him. I don't know.
Is there any doubt in your mind whether or not you'd be alive if he didn't see you?
Because we were in the water 4 days already. Nobody saw us. If they did, they ignored us. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, when we first hit the water, there was like 1,100 of us in the water. If you were hurt, you weren't lasting, but it just died off. Every day we're burying guys, and it was not a good sight to even think about, you know. It was quite an experience.
The plane comes over, so you know you've been spotted, but then it's another day and a half before they come back.
Yeah.
Seems like that might be the longest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was, where are they? Where are they? They're never here. Where are they? Of course, we were like 200 miles off of land, any land. So a ship, even traveling at 6 knots, takes a while to cover 200 miles. And at one point, there were 6 ships came to the rescue. And the Bassett was the one I got on. She was the first one there. And see, when I got picked up, I was by myself.
Well, and the reason you were by yourself, I think, is because you saw them drop something from the plane. They dropped a sono buoy, but you thought it was water?
Yeah. I hung on to that till I got on a raft by myself. When they picked us up, I was sleeping and hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like with everything that you'd been through when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett and you know for the first time you're actually going to live? What did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us. I don't think he was high enough to see us, but he seen the oil slick. We were in the oil, and that's how we got discovered.
He thought maybe he'd find a Japanese submarine to shoot at or something.
I guess that was what he said,
Was there ever a point in those 5 days where you thought about giving up?
I practically did. I was getting tired, course, there was more room on the raft by that time. You know, it was not a raft. It was a rope.
A rope net that you could get on top of and sit.
But you're still in the water up to your neck, holding your head up.
But you don't have to actively hold on with your arms anymore.
You're hanging on to each other until everybody was gone, you know. Just lucky. Just the guys that lived through it was just lucky.
And they took you to the hospital in the Philippines, I believe?
Samara, yeah.
How long did it take you to recover?
Oh, I don't know. They flew us to a hospital out of the Philippines and flew us to a hospital in Guam. So we were in Guam maybe a month and a half. I remember hospital 18. I'll never forget that. Then they went from there to San Diego. Spent some time in a hospital there. I was based at an air base in Detroit after that.
But it was while you were in the hospital, I think, that you first learned, hey, that crate that we took to Tinian, that was the atomic bomb that pretty much ended the war.
Yeah.
Was that kind of an eye-opening realization that that's what it was?
Well, nobody knew about the skipper didn't even know.
Yeah.
It's a big secret till they dropped it.
And speaking of the skipper, because there was such a great loss of life on your ship, it was such a disaster. So many things went wrong. People were looking for someone to blame.
Yeah. Well, he took the blame. He committed suicide for that reason, I guess, because he was getting nasty letters from the mothers and dads, and we would have got hit no matter what. It was they were just out looking for us. Like, I got to know him.
Yeah. And in fact, the commander of that Japanese submarine, I-58, Hashimoto, even came to the U.S. to testify in the court-martial that I would have gotten him whether he zigzagged or not.
Yeah.
And they still convicted him.
Yeah.
So you and your fellow survivors are living with that, bothered by that. He commits suicide in the 60s. And then in the 90s, a 12-year-old, I believe he was a 12-year-old kid in Florida, Hunter Scott, gets into this story and gets the Senate's attention. And they finally retry this case, basically, in Congress and clear his name, exonerate him.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you and your fellow survivors?
Well, finally got it right, you know. No matter what, we were just in a position where we were going to get hit no matter what. It was no accident the Japs were out looking for us. So I was just so lucky because sleeping where I was supposed to be sleeping, that's where the two torpedoes hit.
Yeah.
And I happened to be sleeping three decks higher, just a matter of luck.
There's a lot of what-ifs in your story.
Yeah.
How do you explain them all?
Just a matter of luck, that's all I can say. Oh, she's waving her hand. Things to do.
Your wife believes that God was protecting you so she could marry you someday.
Yeah, that's what she says, yeah. It was just a matter of luck. They weren't even looking for us. I can see it today coming over the horizon, coming right at us. When he came over, I can see him do his wings. And he went out and came back, did it again, and he went straight up. That's when he radioed what he had. But he was our angel ever since then. As a matter of fact, that's what we called him, the angel. Because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking. It was amazing going through that. I don't know how anybody ever lived through it. It was the weather saved us because we didn't have any rough weather, and most of us were hurt. If we had any storms, I don't think you would have lived through it. Mm-hmm. But we had pretty good weather for 4 days. As a matter of fact, the night we got picked up, I think we hit some rough weather. I got picked up at one, a little bit after 1 o'clock in the morning, I was picked up. And I think I was the first one aboard the Bassett.
Again, just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're 18 when this all happens. So you've lived the last 75 years with that experience in mind.
Never leaves.
How has that impacted the way you've lived your life since?
Just appreciate what I had. Because we lost 880 guys that never had that chance. Whoever got in the water, if they were hurt, they didn't live very long. And all I had was burns on my left side. I wasn't hurt very bad, but there was guys in some bad shape. No matter what they do, you'll never can imagine what we went through while in the water. I can't even tell you what it was like. Nobody should go through stuff like that. You're dodging sharks, and then you're dodging guys that are going nuts, attacking you. I'm telling you, I just so lucky to get through that.
That is Harold Bray, now one of just five remaining survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis 76 years ago. We'll hear from another survivor shortly, but first, a different perspective. You heard Harold talk about the speculation as to what the Marines were guarding aboard ship. Mo Rana, the son of Italian immigrants and one of three brothers to serve in World War II, was one of the Marines who unloaded that special cargo on Tinian, where he was assigned to a radar unit with the 17th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. In fact, one of the men he competed against in softball games there was the pilot who would eventually fly the Enola Gay on its mission to Hiroshima, Paul Tibbetts.
We took the island, and the B-29s were coming in, and the security was secured for the island with our radar. And everything. We had a lot of time on our hands, and what would happen is the B-29 pilots from Saipan would fly over to Tinian, and we'd play ball with them, baseball. They'd come in with a team, and we'd have a team, and somebody beat somebody, and then they'd leave because they had a mission to go to at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the heartbreak of this was, if I played ball with you today, the next day when you expect them to come back to play again, then we got the word from their comrades that they were shot down over Japan. We never seen them again. That was a real thing that we had to look forward to. Are we going to see you again? But at the same time, we were enjoying ourselves with them. Everybody wasn't thinking about the war. We were playing ball and everything. But we knew what we had to do, and it was kind of bad. We as Marines on an island, we didn't have any food. We had little C rations, a little can of beans for our meals. No K rations, no anything like that. And every now and then, when the army start coming into the island, they start bringing up the food, like K rations and peaches and the fruit and all that stuff. But we weren't getting any of it. So the word would come out that a ship was coming in with some food, and they needed a couple of trucks from our outfit to go help unload these ships to bring the food to the army dump. So we volunteered. We were always the last two trucks in the train. They're probably about 25, 30 trucks. Uh-huh. We were always the last two trucks. And so when our trucks come in time for the food, the word would get to us down in the hole, our trucks are here. Okay. Everything that went on those two trucks was ours. Mm-hmm. So as they're taken off from the pier, it's hilly territory. You see this train. You visualize this caravan of trucks going straight and round and round. And at one point, two trucks go another way. And they went to our battalion headquarters. We used to steal a lot of food like that. So.
And something tells me that there was some food consumed on the drive from the pier to your
battalion
headquarters. Oh, and
in the hole, we used to break open those cases like mad and eat the peaches and pears. Oh, we had a hell of a time until we loaded up our own two trucks. The word come in one day to the Marine Corps headquarters that we need two trucks, two work units, to go down to the Indianapolis to unload a ship. They called on the Marines to do this because the Army was there, but they didn't fool around with the Army. So when we went down to the docks, we figured everybody volunteered on those trips. Hey, we're going to eat.
You're going to get some food. Yeah.
We went down the box. You've never seen so much brass in your life. We've seen colonels, generals, majors, all over the place. Mm-hmm. Security was top. And we'd all look at each other. What the heck gives here? You know, let's get back in the hole and let's unload the ship. So we got down there in the hole, and all we seen was these big crates. So I says, okay, that's what they wanted loaded. You know, we didn't see any food. Mm-hmm. And we unloaded the crates on our trucks, and the trucks went to a certain spot on Tinian where there were dugouts for these two bombs. Let's say now these two crates were two bombs.
And you had no idea what's
nothing,
in the crates?
Not a thing. We didn't know anything about the bombs or anything. We didn't know what we unloaded until the first day when Tibbetts took the B-29 and bombed Hiroshima. And then when they come back, that's the only time we found out that we had unloaded the A-bomb, two A-bombs.
And when you saw all the brass, all these bigwigs walking around, did you think maybe there is something special in these crates?
Yeah, well, we gave it a thought. Mm-hmm. We gave it a thought. Where the hell's all this brass come from? You know, we made all our own comments, but nobody ever figured we were unloading bombs.
Well, and of course, and you and no one else had any idea what an atomic bomb was. Harry Truman didn't even know it existed till Roosevelt died and he became president.
That's right.
So this was a new thing to everybody. How did you find out that they had dropped the bomb on Hiroshima?
The next morning from out of San Francisco.
You heard it on the radio?
Oh, yeah, on the radio.
Did it click at that point?
Then we said, that's what we unloaded. Mm-hmm. You know, then it came to us that that's what it was unloaded. Then the other one was sent to August 9th, Nagasaki. Major Sweeney was the pilot of that plane.
Mm-hmm.
It was a frightful thing to think about, but it saved a heck of a lot of lives.
I've seen official military estimates from that period that put it at least a million
that's
American lives.
We would have gone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because they were already... And boy, to land on Japan would have been a massacre. And they were ready to defend. They didn't care, but killing them would have meant nothing. They're all for the emperor, all for the emperor.
But what about you? When you realized that you and your fellow Marines, along that path of getting those bombs to the Pacific, had unloaded them from the ship and taken them where they needed to go, did that do anything for you to realize that you played a role in maybe the most significant day in world history?
While we were doing it, nothing.
Well, of course,
we didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
But after we found out, oh, yes, it was a big impression on all of us. Jeez, did we do that? You know, really meaning it in a group like we talk about it. It was unbelievable that instead of food, we unloaded a couple of atomic bombs. We didn't know what the hell an atomic bomb was anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And yes, the impression was there.
That was Marine Corps veteran Mo Rana, who wouldn't be able to claim he unloaded the components of the atomic bomb if the Indianapolis had been sunk before, not after, delivering that world-changing cargo. What a thin margin that was. And we'll hear from another survivor of the Indianapolis tragedy when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking 76 years since the sinking and the miraculous rescue of survivors from the USS Indianapolis. The virtual reunion this last week included the first mention of Project 888, an opportunity for you to help honor the 888 men from the Indianapolis who died either in the sinking or prior to that when the ship was kamikazed. Follow the USS Indianapolis on Facebook for more information as that effort progresses. I do have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find the trailer for Sarah Vladek's 2015 documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. If you've never seen it, you will not regret pulling it up online, and this will give you a little taste.
We were never allowed to tell the disaster.
I never talked to my wife or my kids for 25 years about this.
Indianapolis changed history. It was a ship that changed history, but the men pay the price.
As far as I'm concerned, it should be told what really happened out there in the water. I started into the Navy when I was 16, and I saw all 10 battles.
I saw the flag raised, not Suribachi.
And I personally helped load and unload components of the atomic bomb.
On the 30th of July, we were hit by two torpedoes from a submarine and sunk.
Next thing I know, the ship's going right out from under me.
All I did was just walk over the side of the ship and into the water.
I didn't jump up the ship. The ship left me.
I opened my eyes under the water, and I could see this ship was coming down on top of me.
I never did know how to swim, and the Navy never taught me how to swim.
And here's all these sharks going around. Come right across your legs like that.
It was chaos.
We couldn't understand why we weren't rescued.
A lot of them lost the will to live.
You look at their eyes, they're lost. You see people, and they're not there.
Us guys decided, well, hell, that's where we're going to die.
Then, there on that fourth day, I said, I hear a plane. And we began to splash water. We began to yell. We began to pray. Everything. And seemingly, when he got to a point that had he gone any further, he would have gone over. But you know what he did? He made a dive.
How did I make it with nothing to eat, no water to drink, no sleep for 5 nights? Tell them the Lord was with me.
If somebody wrote this up as fiction, nobody would believe it happened.
People don't realize the politics in the armed forces.
All the headlines were about the captain being court-martialed.
Many a head should have rolled before they ever got to the captain.
It's the story that's not been told. Those don't want to remember. They don't want to recall this. It's too much. But I'm a dummy. I think it ought to be told.
It should be told, and it is told so powerfully in that documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy, and in the best-selling book by Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent, not to mention books by Doug Stanton and Dan Kurzman. One man mentioned in all of those is Harpo Salaya. Like Harold Bray, Harpo was just 18 years old, and here's what he remembers about the ship being torpedoed.
I had gone to, in my compartment, there they had some vents that bring air down. And it was very hot in those days, and I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't we go up on top deck? He said, and our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, and we can wake each other up. And so I went with him, and we went up. But there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that, but I was got used to it, and my crew chief was laughing at when we went to bed, and that's where I was when they repeated it. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on, because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands where I had my hands off, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there then. So it was a pretty good sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was, but what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off. The blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket. And he said, you can't. He said, the ship is going down. I said, I just came from the front of it. He said, the whole front end is gone. He said, I said, what? He said, oh, yeah. He said, it's going to go. So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know. So I didn't see Santos for 3 days. I had always thought I had knocked him out or something. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there.
Well, those have to be the three longest days of your life. And this one of the most incredible parts of this story. For more than 3 days, the Navy didn't know that you had sunk. Is that something that you've been able to make sense of since it happened?
I haven't. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, and then a lot of them say that there was a couple of ships that got an SOS, and they knew about it and stuff like that. But it's just one of those things, and I happen to be very lucky to have met later on the pilot that found us in the water, and we got pretty close, and I enjoyed meeting him afterwards. Everybody at the reunions, all the survivors there, they called him our angel. You know, he was the angel that happened to come by, and he just happened to be going by there. I mean, not looking for us or nothing. Another couple of days, and I don't think they'd have found anything. They'd have just found the oil slicks or something like that.
Well, and that was my next question, because obviously it was too late for quite a few, and they estimate that only about 300 of the 1,200 died when the ship was hit, and so then you have almost 900 men who are out in the water trying to survive, and if you're just trying to survive the conditions, that's bad enough. You got to stay hydrated, you have to stay afloat, but when you have sharks in the water killing people, I can't imagine what that was like for you. Did you see fellow sailors being eaten by sharks?
Yeah, that was kind of rough. I couldn't imagine myself. I mean, it was hard for me to. I stayed, I guess, I would say about 27 years without saying anything about it. I never talked to anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
If they asked me something about it, I turn around and walk the other way. But nowadays, I have learned to cope with it, so I haven't been able to talk to people and stuff like that.
How did you survive, and how close did you come to having a shark take off a piece of you?
Well, I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all this stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. So that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
Kind of a dazed deal. I mean, they come down with landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which the Bassett ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, the deal that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top. I remember the sailors that took care of me. They were on this Bassett ship. They did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, no. I said, want more? No, no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much. And yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so.
How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying. I had my mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that metal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth. Mm. That metal stayed in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
Well, clearly you feel blessed to have survived one of just a few more than 300 survivors of a ship of 1,200.
Oh, my God, yes.
And I know that you're reminded of it every year about this time, and I'm sure it doesn't change from year to year how thankful you are. But I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital. Nowadays they call it something else, post-traumatic or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder?
In those days, they called it, they said you were crazy or something like that. You know, they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now. You know,
I know you're often reminded about July 30th, 1945, the day the Indianapolis went down. When you think about all the men who lost their lives there, is there a way that you honor them, or their memory, or way that you think they ought to be remembered?
When they asked me about these young boys from Iraq coming in, which are 18, 19 years old, and I go back to them and I tell them, you know, in 1944, 45, when I was in the service, I say, these boys were only 18 or 19 years old. They were fighting in World War II. God, and they were fighters. God, I wouldn't. They fought a hell of a war, you know, in 1940. And they were young men. They were not. You figure that they were older men, but they weren't.
To me, it's the best thing that has come out is a documentary that has come out. That's the closest that I've seen that has been the best telling of how the survivors came out of it and all that stuff. And she interviewed quite a few survivors. So she did a very good job on doing the documentary on that, you know. I remember when we first came out, when the war was over, there were very small little articles about it, you know, about how many shipmates we had lost and stuff like that. But very small articles, and it wasn't very well known until most of these books started coming out, you know, Fatal Voyage and all those other ones that came in. And now that Sarah has come out with this documentary has been up in Europe and stuff like that being shown and everything.
And I remember the first time that we spoke years ago, you said that there were parts of this that still came back to you and bothered you. Does that still happen to you?
It's been bothering me for all the time. I mean, this doesn't go away. I mean, the Veterans Administration has sent so many psychiatrists and everybody to come over and talk to me and everything. And everyone's tried to say that, tried to forget, tried to do that. And you can't do that. That comes to you almost every day. You can't go to bed at night and not think about it. I don't think I'll ever forget until they put me on the ground.
And, of course, we hope that day is a long way off. That is Harpo Salaya, one of just five remaining survivors of the USS Indianapolis. I know I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. The USS Indianapolis page on Facebook is definitely worth a follow if this story fascinates you the way it does me. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.